Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Bill Bryson. Bryson is more than a travel writer or simply an author of nonfiction. His books are unexpected trips into cultures, some close at hand, some remote, from one of the most astute and funny observers of our time. His books include The Lost Continent, A Walk in the Woods, Notes from a Small Island, and the memoir of his childhood, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. His book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, won the Royal Society's Adventist Prize, as well as the Descartes Prize, the European Union's highest literary award. Nearly all of his books have been bestsellers. In this talk, with his signature dry humor, Bill Bryson discusses the incidences that were the catalysts for many of his nonfiction books. Bryson spoke in Portland in 2010. Here he is in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me here. I'm so delighted to be back in Portland. It is, and I'm not saying this just to suck up, it is the loveliest city in America. It really is. It's the most fantastic place. And I always forget how friendly it is. I went out for a little walk around the downtown today, and in less than 10 minutes, I had four people ask me if I was okay for change. I'm absolutely honored to be here as part of such a distinguished series as this. And wow, I mean, what a space. This is the most classy venue I've ever spoken in, I think. It is really just quite the most remarkable place. It wasn't that long ago, it really wasn't, that I did a reading to an audience of five people at a Barnes & Noble in Scranton, Pennsylvania. They only put out six chairs, so they thought it was quite a good turnout for me. And of the five people who came, one was the store manager, who obviously wasn't going to buy anything anyway. Two others were people who had retired, they were friends of my parents who had retired to Pennsylvania and just wanted to know how my mom was doing. The fourth person was a guy who was also named Bill Bryson, who had come from West Virginia or Philadelphia, some far-off place, so that we could stand together and stare in amazement at his driver's license and confirm that we did indeed miraculously have the same name. And then the fifth person was his wife, who didn't seem to be wanting to spend the evening with anybody named Bill Bryson. So this is just fantastic. I had to look at I can hardly see anything now, but I had to look earlier. Some of you are up the top. I must be so far back you can hardly see me. I'd better. Oh, I'm so pleased you're out there. So I just thought maybe I'd better describe myself to you. I'm about 5'11", and I weigh about 150 pounds or so. Willowy is the word that usually comes to mind when people see me. I do also have to say I'm always a little bit slightly daunted when I find myself in a situation like this, not just in a hall of this grandeur, because there's something about getting up in front of an audience altogether that it makes you feel as if you're rather important, or you ought to try and say something important or significant or even profound. And I need to warn you right away that I've never been very good at profundities. I'm one of those people who always just blurts out the wrong thing. The last time I can remember this happening was I had to fill out an author questionnaire for a publication of W.H. Smith, a British bookstore chain. And one of the questions on the questionnaire was, what would you like people to be saying about you 100 years from now? It was quite a tough question. I thought really hard about them. What would I have people say about me 100 years from now if I could have them say anything? And the answer I gave was, and the amazing thing is, he's still sexually active. So let me apologize at once if what I say tonight isn't suitably astute or incisive. It's not for lack of respect for the occasion, believe me. Now, I don't know quite what you expected me here tonight. I looked with about 10 minutes ago with a slight amount of horror at the program that the leaflet that was formed for this, because it says Bill Bryson at home, and the one thing I wasn't really going to talk about tonight was my new book, At Home. That isn't to say I don't want you to go out and buy it afterwards, but I was going to, I just thought we'd have a sort of informal evening. I wanted, first of all, to tell you my bear story, just because I love to tell it. And then I thought I would just talk a little bit about who I am and how I got here and read one or two passages from some of my earlier books. And then at the end, as Andrew said, I'll gladly take questions. So let me start, if I may, with the bear story. The bear story is an outgrowth of an experience I had a few years ago when I tried, not very successfully, to hike the Appalachian Trail in the company of a fellow Iowan named Stephen Katz. Now, the Appalachian Trail, as I'm sure you know, is a very, very, very difficult long-distance hiking trail that runs through 14 states from Springer Mountain in Georgia all the way up to Mount Katahdin in Maine. And it was, for us particularly, it was really quite a big challenge. And if you read the book, you'll know that I grew somewhat preoccupied with the dangers of bear attacks while hiking on this Appalachian Trail. And I was very, very gratified to discover after the book came out that lots and lots of people all over North America share these concerns, because I got letters by the sackful from people giving me advice on how to avoid bear attacks while hiking. And here the basic advice seems to be always to go hiking with someone who can't run as fast as you can. But there was one letter I got from a lady in New Hampshire, where I was then living, that particularly pleased me. And she said that when you go hiking out west in this part of the country, in grizzly bear territory, and of course, as you all know, grizzly bears are very dangerous creatures, there are two things they tell you should do wherever you go. They tell you that, first of all, you should wear little bells on your clothing, because this actually alerts the bears you're coming, and you don't overtake them by surprise. And the second thing they tell you should do everywhere you go is you should watch out on the ground in front of you for grizzly bear scat or dung. And the way you can recognize grizzly bear scat is that it has little bells in it. Now, I wanted to start off with a short reading, if I may. It's from a book I did a few years ago about growing up in Iowa, called The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid. It's just a memoir about... That's so cool. People, you mention the title of a book and people clap. It's like being at a rock concert. When I do the reading, are you going to start waving cigarette lighters? Anyway... It's a book about growing up in Iowa in the 50s, and I've always felt that I was really, really lucky to get to grow up in the middle of the country, in the middle of the 20th century, in a nice, happy, well-settled, middle-class family. I don't think there really was ever a better time to be small and to be growing up. It was just a great, great age. But I also think that childhood, for most of us, wherever it happens and in whatever period it happens, it tends to be kind of a sort of miraculously magical experience. And one of the things I loved about my childhood, and I think is true pretty much universally, is about childhood, is that it has this wonderful capacity for things, no matter how bad they seem at the time, to turn out for the best in the end. And that's the moral of this passage that I want to read to you. And the background to it is that I came home from school one day and discovered, to my horror, that my dear old mother, in a well-meaning move, had accepted an invitation on my behalf to go to a place called Lake Okwabee for the day with some neighbors of ours, the Milton family. Now, normally, I'd have been very excited about that. Going to Lake Okwabee was fun. It was the most exciting place to go from Des Moines nearby. And it was, it was always a pleasure to go there. But the idea of going with the Milton family just filled me with dread and horror and lots of other feelings of deep foreboding, because the Miltons were this obnoxious, unlikable, deeply unattractive family. And worst of all, the little boy who was my age, whose name was Milton, that the family honestly had a long tradition of giving the firstborn male in each generation the same first and last name. And Milton was just this little drip. He was the biggest drip in school, but to be with him was a kind of social suicide. And so And you know what it's like when you're 10 years old, when you're confronted with the prospect of doing something, spending a whole day doing something, it feels like it's going to be an eternity. So I really, really, really didn't want to do this. So I went to Lake Aquabi in a mood of gloomy submission, crammed into the Milton's ancient dinky Nash, a car with the comfort and stylish zip of a chest freezer, expecting the worst and receiving it. We got heatedly lost for an hour in the immediate vicinity of the state capitol building, something that was almost impossible for any normal family to do in Des Moines. And when we finally reached Aquabi, spent 90 minutes more, with much additional disputation, unloading the car and setting up a base camp on the small, shady lawn beside the artificial beach. Mrs. Milton distributed sandwiches, which were made of some kind of pink paste that looked like, and for all I know was, the stuff my grandmother used to secure her dentures to her gums. I went for a little walk with my sandwich and left it with a dog that would have nothing to do with it. Having eaten, we had to sit quietly for 45 minutes before swimming, lest we get cramps and die horribly in 6 inches of water. Mrs. Milton timed this period with an egg timer and encouraged us to close our eyes and have a little nap until it was time to swim. Far out in the middle of Lake Aquabi, there was moored a large wooden platform on which stood an improbably high diving board, a kind of wooden Eiffel Tower. It was, I'm sure, the tallest wooden structure in Iowa, if not the entire Midwest. The platform was so far out from shore that hardly anyone ever visited it. Just occasionally, some teenage daredevils would swim out to have a look around. Sometimes they would even climb the many ladders to the high board and even cautiously creep out onto it. But they always retreated when they saw just how suicidally far the water was below them. No human being had ever been known to jump from the high board at Lake Aquabi. So it was quite a surprise when, as the egg timer dinged our liberation, Mr. Milton jumped up and began doing neck rolls and arm stretches and announced that he intended to have a dive off the high board. Mr. Milton had been something of a diving star at Lincoln High School, it must be said, but that was on a 10-foot board on an indoor pool. Aquabi was of another order of magnitude altogether. Clearly, he was out of his mind. Word of his insane intention was already spreading along the beach when Mr. Milton jogged into the water and swam with steady, even strokes out to the distant platform. He was just a tiny, remote stick figure when he got there, but even from such a distance, the high board seemed to loom hundreds of feet above him. It took him at least 20 minutes to make his way up the zigzag of ladders to the top. Once at the summit, he strode up and down the board, bounced on it experimentally several times, then took some deep breaths and finally assumed a position at the fixed end of the board with his arms at his sides. It was clear from his posture and poised manner that he was going to go for it. By now, all the people on the beach and in the water, several hundred altogether, had stopped whatever they were doing and were just silently watching. Mr. Milton stood stock still for quite a long time. Then, with a nice touch of theatricality, he raised his arms, ran like hell down the long board, and imagine, if you will, an Olympic gymnast sprinting at full tilt towards a distant springboard, and you've got something of the spirit of it, took one enormous bounce and launched himself high and outwards in a perfect swan dive. It was a beautiful thing to behold, I must say. He fell with flawless grace for what seemed whole minutes. Such was the beauty of the moment and the breathless silence of the watching multitudes that the only sound to be heard across the lake was the faint whistle of his body tearing through the air towards the water far, far below. It may only be my imagination, but he seemed, after a time, to start to glow red, like an incoming meteor. He was really moving. I don't know what happened, whether he lost his nerve or realized that he was approaching the water at a murderous velocity or what. But about 3/4 of the way down, he seemed suddenly to have second thoughts about the whole business and began abruptly to flail, like someone entangled in bedding in a bad dream or whose chute hasn't opened. When he was perhaps 30 feet above the water, he gave up on flailing and tried a new tack. He spread his arms and legs wide in the shape of an X, evidently hoping that by exposing a maximum amount of surface area, he would somehow slow his fall. It didn't work. He hit the water, impacted, really, is the word for it, at over 600 miles an hour, with a report so loud that it made birds fly out of trees up to 3 miles away. At such a speed, water effectively becomes a solid. I don't believe Mr. Milton penetrated it at all, but just bounced off it about 15 feet, limbs suddenly very loose, and then lay on top of it, quite still, like an autumn leaf spinning gently. He was towed to shore by two passing fishermen in a rowboat and carried gently to a grassy area by half a dozen onlookers who carefully set him down on an old blanket. There he spent the rest of the afternoon on his back, arms and legs bent slightly and elevated. Every bit of frontal surface area on his body, from his thinning hairline to his toenails, had a raw, abraded look, as if he had suffered some unimaginable misfortune involving an industrial sander. Occasionally, he accepted small sips of water, but otherwise was too traumatized to speak. Later the same afternoon, Milton Jr. cut himself with a hatchet that he had been told on no account to touch, so that he ended up bleeding, in pain, and in trouble all at the same time. It was the best day of my life. Thank you. There was something else I was wanting to do tonight, if it's not too important to me to do, but a few years ago, I introduced to the world a new program, a simple program of 10 rules to make the world a better place. And they were all very sensible to me. It's very sensible rules that would make Earth a much finer place to live on. And I introduced them widely for a time, and I regret to say that nowhere were they taken up by anyone. And I thought, when I heard that I was coming to Portland, Oregon, I thought, well, these are steady, reliable people. So I will try once more to reintroduce these rules in the hope that you will take them to heart. You will actually get them going and sort of get the ball rolling here. There's only 10 of these rules, but they're very, very important to me, and I really would be very much obliged to you if you would take them seriously. In order to make the world a better place, the following rules will take force with immediate effect across the planet. 1, it is no longer permitted to be stupid and slow. You must choose one or the other. 2, people who wear articles of clothing on which the manufacturer's name or logo is prominently displayed must also wear a badge saying, yes, I am an idiot. 3, with immediate effect, the following are illegal. Goat's cheese, tofu, Glenn Beck. Pronouncing etc. as if it had a K in it. And all medical procedures ending in the word oscopy. 4, when standing in line to purchase food or beverages, anyone who has to leave the line to ask his or her partner whether the partner wants chocolate powder on their cappuccino or a cinnamon stick or anything like that will be escorted from the premises. Anyone who gets to the front of a line and says, now what do I want? And purses his lips thoughtfully and drums his fingers on his chin while studying the ordering options as if for the first time, will be taken outside and shot. 5, any electronic clock or other timing device on which the time is set by holding down a button and scrolling laboriously through the minutes and hours is illegal. Also, when you're trying to set the alarm on such a device for, say, 7 a.m., and the numbers get to about 6:56 and then suddenly speed up, and you discover to your dismay that you've gone past the desired hour and have to start all over again, that is extremely illegal. 6, photocopiers will clearly indicate where you are supposed to put the piece of paper you want photocopied and will provide an immediate refund and spoken apology each time they produce a horizontal photocopy when a vertical one is desired. Any user of a photocopier who instructs the machine to produce a giant photocopy or 100 copies of a single document or anything like that, and who then does not reset the machine to its normal settings, will be hunted down by the photocopier police and made to drink a cup of toner. 7, all cars will come equipped with gas caps on both sides. And at the rear, and all gas station hoses will be at least 6 feet longer. 8, henceforth, the check-in time in hotels is when I arrive. 9, all reviews of Mr. Bryson's work will, with immediate effect, be submitted to Mr. Bryson for correction and helpful revision before publication. And finally, 10, all Americans will appreciate irony. Britons will understand that 2 ice cubes in a drink is not nearly enough. Thank you for helping to make the world a better place. Your cooperation is appreciated. Thank you. Now, I know I said about all Americans will appreciate irony. I know I didn't need to say that here, because I know you have fantastic, well-developed, sophisticated senses of humor in Oregon. I mean, I've seen that already. And but it is a strange thing that, you know, I think in Iowa, where I grew up, I think we had a really, really good, well-developed sense of humor. And it's based on the whole idea of, you know, being quite self-effacing, not taking yourself too seriously. If anyone does get too presumptuous, then you're always taking them down a peg. It's really quite closely tied to understatement and appreciation of irony, and it's really quite dry. It is indeed what the British think of as the British sense of humor. And because I grew up in Iowa, and we made jokes like that, in that kind of vein, and then I went off as a young man straight to England, where the sense of humor was essentially identical, I just assumed that the senses of humor were the same everywhere, and that was a universal quality. And then in 1995, we came back to America and settled in Hanover, New Hampshire, and I discovered that that's not the case at all. Now, people in Hanover are wonderful people, and we were made very, very welcome there, but the jokes that I was making with people just didn't go down in the same way. It was a very strange experience. I don't know whether it was an Eastern U.S. thing or a New England thing or maybe just a New Hampshire thing, but we found that the kind of everyday little quips that you make with your neighbors, I'm sure you make here, they just didn't seem to register as jokes with people. I remember I had an experience where a neighbor of ours had a tree come down in a storm one night. It wasn't a very big tree. When I came out of the house the next day, he was cutting it up into even smaller pieces and putting them on the roof of his car to take away for disposal. But it was a kind of bushy tree, and so the pieces were sort of hanging off the sides. And so I just said to him as I came out the door, I said, "Good morning, Ted. I see your camouflage in your car." And he looked at me and he said, "No, we had a tree come down in a storm last night, and I'm just taking it away for disposal." And after that, I found I couldn't stop myself making these little jokes with him as a kind of test. There was another occasion where I'd had one of those nightmare experiences where it just took forever to get back from the West Coast to the East Coast by plane. It was one of those days where there were storms all over the Rockies or something, and people everywhere were being held up. It was just a kind of nightmare day to be traveling. And I spent hours just delayed in Denver, as I recall. And when I got home, I was telling him about this, and he said to me, "Who did you fly with?" And I said, "I don't know. They were all strangers." And he didn't get that either. And eventually, my wife made me stop making jokes altogether for him. So it's really wonderful to hear you laughing here tonight. Because it would have been awful if you'd been sitting in silence when I was saying those things.
You're listening to a talk by Bill Bryson. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and more with Bill Bryson is coming up.
But all of this is a kind of an introduction to a story. I want to tell you a true story. I do think the British are actually the masters, certainly at the kind of really dry quip. And there's a story I can tell you that illustrates that perfectly. A very good friend of mine is the sports editor of the London Times. And although he's English, he knows more about baseball than anybody I've ever met, except possibly my own father, who was a sports writer on the Des Moines Register. But Keith, my friend at the London Times, really, really understands baseball. And he knows that I really love it. And in 2003, just after we had moved back to England, this friend of mine, Keith, called me up one day at my home in England. And he said, "Have you been following what's been going on in the major leagues this, this season. This was in late September, and the season was just coming to a close. And I said, have I? Because what was happening was that in 2003, as the season was coming to a close, the two teams that had the most momentum going into the playoff period were the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox. Now, if you follow baseball, you'll need to cast your mind back just a little bit, because in 2003, the Red Sox had not had all the success they've had in the more recent years. They were still a perennial last-place team. They were a team that always disappointed their fans in August. You know, they always would collapse, as the Cubs still do. And so these two teams were the sort of perennial losers in baseball. And the Cubs, at that time, had not won a World Series, and indeed have still not won one since 1908, and the Red Sox had not won one since 1918 at that point. So they had something like 180 years of collective failure between them. And yet here was this possibility that as the World Series was looming, these were the two teams that would be going into the very good chance that they'd be the two teams going into the World Series. And obviously, if they met in the World Series, one of them would have to win and so end this long and troubling drought that team had experienced for all these decades. Well, going to the World Series was something I've always wanted to do. My dad, as I said, was a sports writer for the Des Moines Register. He loved baseball and instilled in me and his other children a really deep, profound admiration for baseball as a game. And coming from a place like Des Moines, Iowa, it was very, very exciting for him to go to the World Series. Every year for 40 years, he went to the World Series. And when he came home, he would be telling us not just about this exciting sporting spectacle, but also about just the excitement of going to some far-off exotic city like New York or San Francisco or wherever he'd gone that year for the World Series. So it seemed kind of doubly exciting to me. The idea of going to the World Series was something I had always wanted to do and had never done. It was really the one dream in life that had still eluded me. So in 2003, when the situation was the Cubs and the Red Sox looked like they'd be going to the World Series, Keith Blackmore, my friend from the sports editor at the London Times, called me up at home and said, look, Bill, we've been talking about it here in the office, and if it turns out that it is the Cubs and the Red Sox in the World Series, we're wondering if you would go and cover it for us, because we think that it would take an American to explain the kind of improbable momentousness of this occasion to a British readership. Would you go? I said, would I go? Keith, I'll go for free. Honestly, you don't have to pay me anything. Just get me tickets to the games and a hotel in each city, and I'll go. In fact, just to show you just how much I want to go, I'm going to go to my desk right now and get my desk diary, and we will confirm it here and now so that you can never change your mind, that you'll be locked into this. So I went and got my calendar off my desk, and I came back to the phone, and I made a crestfallen noise, and I said, Keith, I can't believe it. You know, I dreamed all my life of going to a World Series, and now this is going to be very possibly the most exciting World Series in modern times, and I can't go because it so happens that my daughter is getting married that week. And he was quiet for a long moment, and he said, look, Bill, your daughter may get married again. Now, I wanted to read you a passage from a little book I did a few years ago now, and it's a book that not many people have read because it sort of came and went very quickly. But the idea of it was that I was approached in Hyde Park in London several years ago by a personable young man named Dan McLean, who recognized me. And we had never met. And he came up to me and told me that he worked for Care International, the charity, and asked me if I'd be interested in or willing somehow to support them, to help them with their work. And I said, well, sure, in principle. So, I mean, Care is this organization. If you're old enough, you'll remember Care Packages. That's what Care is. And Care is this organization that is very active in third world nations all over the planet, doing really, you know, very good heroic work for lots and lots of countries. And Dan McLean and I met sometime later and had a pint and talked this over. And what we decided was that I would go to one of the countries where they have a lot of projects. Kenya was the country that we eventually settled on. And I would visit their various projects, and I would write an article about them for one of the London Sunday papers. The idea being that by writing about it, it would help to raise their profile very slightly, and then I would donate my fee from the paper to Care, and it would generate just a small amount of income for them. And I mentioned this to my London publisher at dinner one night, and he said, no, don't do that. He said, go there, do what you're going to do, but we'll do it as a little book, and we can sell it by the cash registers at Christmas time. People can buy it as a stocking filler, and we'll give all of our profits, and you can give all the royalties, and with any luck, we'll generate some useful amount of money from this exercise. So I thought, oh, great, well, that'll be terrific, that'll be wonderful. And then my New York publishers heard about it, and they'd agreed and decided to do exactly the same thing. So all the publishers got behind it in a big way, and it was wonderful. We went off to Kenya, and I had the most fantastic experience there. And the result was a little tiny book that sold at Christmas time, only for a year or so. But it was quite a successful undertaking. And for me, it was the most wonderful experience. I mean, there is nothing more heartening than to go and be on the ground and taken around by people who work for an organization and just see how much difference it makes with a little application of money and technology, and how much it can change the lives of people who are in a disadvantaged position. It was just the most heartening week I've ever spent. I really, really just loved it. But there was one thing that we had to do during the week that was hanging over me for the whole of that week, and indeed had been hanging over me for weeks and weeks before that. Because we had to go and visit a refugee camp run by CARE way out in the northern deserts of Kenya. And it's a camp that had 100,000 Somalian refugees living in a massive tent city out in the middle of nowhere in the deserts. And these poor people from Somalia, they couldn't go home to Somalia because they were enemies of the regime and they'd have been slaughtered if they tried to. But Kenya at the same time couldn't just accept them into its own society because it just couldn't handle 100,000 indigent people suddenly appearing on the streets of Nairobi and Mombasa and so on. So these people were stuck out in the middle of nowhere while the world decided what to do with them. And the world took years and years to decide. Some of these people were born there and actually graduated from high school at the same camp. They'd never been outside the barbed wire perimeter of this place. So it was very important that we went to see them, and they were really excited to have anybody from the outside world coming in to see them. But the reason I didn't want to go was because the only way to get there was in a little airplane. And I'm absolutely phobic about little airplanes for reasons that I hope will become clear from this passage. A few years ago, I was on a scheduled flight on a 16-seater prop plane from Logan Airport in Boston to my then local airport in New Hampshire when the plane got lost in foggy weather and couldn't find the airport. For 40 long minutes, we flew around in a curiously perplexed manner, occasionally dropping through the low clouds, which I couldn't help noticing we shared with many mountaintops, before the pilot got his bearings, or maybe just lucky, and put us on the runway with a descent so steep that I sometimes still sit upright in bed at 3 a.m. thinking about it. I vowed then that I would never go on another light aircraft, ever. Then 2 years ago, I was on a flight in a light aircraft across Fiji, almost, but not quite, ahead of the leading edge of the biggest, bounciest tropical storm I ever hoped to experience, and I vowed then that really, absolutely, and under no circumstances would I ever set foot on a light aircraft again. And now here I was about to fly 400 kilometers into bandit country in a charter plane in a third world nation. I mentioned my reservations to Nick Southern, one of the CARE people looking after us in Kenya, at breakfast the next morning. "Oh, I know just what you mean," Nick said with feeling. "I'm petrified myself." "Well, that's not quite what I was hoping to hear, Nick," I said. "No, absolutely bloody petrified," Nick went on. "Well, Nick, look, I was rather counting on you to tell me that everything is going to be fine and that these planes never crash." "Oh, no, they crash all the time," Nick said. "Well, I know they do, Nick, I know, but I was hoping that you would tell me that somehow in Kenya they don't, and that for some reason that hadn't occurred to me, the world's most outstanding and gifted pilots come here to do charter work." Nick didn't seem to be listening to me at all any longer. "No, crash all the time," he repeated again for emphasis. "Poor Richard Leakey lost both his legs in a plane crash in Kenya, you know." "I'd heard that," I said. "And he was one of the lucky ones," Nick added enigmatically. Well, an hour after we had this conversation, there were four of us, from me and three people from CARE, Dan McLean, the guy from who met me in Hyde Park, and two people working for CARE in Kenya, were standing at a little airport at a place called Malindi on the Indian Ocean coast, looking at this plane that was going to take us 400 kilometers into the northern deserts to this refugee camp at Dadaab. And I can't tell you how relieved I was to discover that the plane looked pretty sound. It was either reasonably new or had recently been resprayed, but it was the finish of it was in pretty good condition, and it looked okay. And we walked around it, examining it as closely as we could. We kicked the tires and ran our finger along the propeller edge and just sort of looked at it, and it seemed okay. And even better was the pilot, who was this wonderful guy of completely indeterminate ethnicity named Nino. He was a person who just exuded an air of calm authority. He was a person who just, in his company, you felt a kind of assurance and calmness. And he was, he had a clean new uniform on. He was obviously sober. He just had a you know, gave an impression of reliability. And it was very calm and reassuring. And he assured us that he didn't want to crash any more than we did. And so it just felt really good. And then we took off in the plane, and 10 minutes after we took off, I just felt like a complete idiot, because everything was perfect. I mean, the plane was good in sound condition, obviously. We were flying into desert, so there wasn't any weather anywhere. I mean, we were just flying through blue, cloudless skies. There wasn't a puff of turbulence anywhere. It was absolutely ideal flying conditions. And how lucky was I? I mean, here I am in a little airplane getting to look out a window on this fantastic, marvelous African landscape. How many people in life get to do that? So I just felt like I'd been a complete idiot for worrying about all this for so long, when actually it was a great privilege. It was a great treat. And the flight was completely uneventful, and it went very smoothly, and took 90 minutes as promised, and we landed at this dirt airstrip and got off the plane and went off immediately, went and had this incredibly full and busy and slightly frantic and really quite emotionally taxing day at this refugee camp. Very, very exciting, very, very heartening in lots of ways, but just an extremely full day, so that I didn't have a chance to reflect on this at all again until the day was finally over. And towards the end of the day, we go back to the dirt airstrip, and there's Nino smiling broadly, waiting by the plane. And now all we have to do is get in this little plane and fly for another 90 minutes across desert, this time in a slightly contrary direction to Nairobi this time. And when we land in Nairobi, we will land there, we will get taken to a nice hotel, and we'll have a nice meal, and the evening will be pleasant, and this whole kind of episode that I've been worried about will all be over with. So I just have 90 minutes more to get through, and this thing that I've been dreading for so long will be just a memory. So I felt very, very good, and we take off again, and the conditions were perfect again, and it was really beautiful. The sun was starting to go down, and it was just a lovely, lovely evening for flying. Everything was perfect until we got about 10 minutes from Nairobi. 10 minutes before we arrived in Nairobi, I found out why Nino had been a little coy when I'd asked him about flying conditions ahead. Ahead of us, parked right over the city, was a massive storm. It looked very dark and very threatening. The thing about sitting near the front in a small aircraft is that you can see everything, to left, to right, and straight ahead. None of it anywhere in the vicinity of Nairobi looked good at all. We were over the outer suburbs of the city and some way into our descent before we hit any turbulence, and it wasn't too bad. It didn't feel as if the wings were going to be shaken off or anything like that. But then the rain came, suddenly and noisily, in staccato fashion. It was as if the windshield were being pounded by wet bullets. Maybe it's always like that in the cockpit, and you just don't know when you're a passenger in a separate compartment further back. But this was most assuredly unnerving. Worse, after a minute, it became clear that Nino couldn't see a thing. He began to move his head from spot to spot around the windshield, putting his nose right up to the glass, looking for any tiny bit of visibility in the impenetrable murk ahead. I couldn't understand why he didn't put the windshield wiper on, then looked more closely and saw there wasn't a windshield wiper. I glanced across at Nick, and we shared a single telepathic thought. There's no windshield wiper. Actually, two telepathic thoughts. There's no windshield wiper, and we're all going to die. Nino was now bobbing around the seat in the manner of someone who's trying to land an airplane while his pants are on fire. It appeared that by looking out the two side windows, he could get a very rough fix on our location, but evidently only very rough, because twice he banked extremely sharply and abruptly, as if swerving out of the path of a big oncoming building or something. This was rapidly becoming worse than my worst nightmare. But still he pressed on, For one long minute, nothing much happened at all. We just flew forward in a seemingly straight line, continuously descending through an impenetrable wall of water. When we were some small distance above the ground, 70 or 80 feet, say, and there was still nothing to be seen in front of us, I was pretty comfortably certain that we were all going to die in the next few moments. I remember being appalled about this, peeved even, but curiously nothing more than that. And then bang, and I use the word advisedly, of course, right before us, rushing at us at a ridiculously accelerated speed, was a runway. Nino tilted the plane and dropped us with the sort of suddenness that made our hats rise off our heads. We landed hard and decidedly off-center, and for a long moment, the one truly unnerving moment of the entire experience, it seemed that he wouldn't be able to keep control, that we would hit the grass alongside the runway and somersault into 1,000 pieces. But he managed somehow to hold us steady, and after a small eternity, we came to a stop just outside a hangar. I'm naming my first child Nino, Dan said quietly from the back. Nick was staring at his hand and a large piece of fuselage he seemed to have pulled off in the course of the landing. Nino took off his headset and turned around beaming. Sorry about that, chaps, he said. Had a little trouble spotting the runway. Why is there no windshield wiper? I asked with difficulty. Oh, they're no use with a single engine, Nino said, pointing to the propeller directly in front. Best wiper in the world couldn't keep up with the spray coming off that thing. Somehow this didn't seem an entirely satisfactory explanation, but I was happy to leave it at that. Besides, I had a sudden overwhelming urge to drink my body weight in alcohol. And I can tell you this for certain now. However many years are left to me on Earth, and wherever fate takes me, the only way I will ever be killed by a light aircraft is if one falls on me. Thank you. I see time is marching on, so I think what I'd like to do, if I may, is just do one more brief concluding reading so that there'll be adequate time for taking questions. The reading I'd like to do for you is from a book that was published here in America with the title In a Sunburned Country. It was published in England. Oh, there's the, thank you. Thank you. And it was published in England with the title Down Under. And the reason it had two different titles was that just the book was supposed to be called No Worries Everywhere. Because, as you'll know, that's a catchphrase in Australia, and it seemed like a really good title. And indeed, it was such a good title that somebody had already used it. And the publishers discovered that right at the 11th hour and said to me, we've got to come up with an alternative title. Send us some alternatives. And so I made up lists of alternative titles in a real hurry, and sent them off to the publishers, both in London and New York. And it turned out, for various reasons, because there was a certain urgency to this, that the two of them couldn't agree at all about what was the best title. They just couldn't agree what would work best in their respective markets. And so, just in some haste and confusion, the book came out with two different titles in each country. And what happened, the unexpected, to me, unexpected consequence of that, was that the people would buy in a sunburned country here, and then go to England and see Down Under, or vice versa, and they would actually go to the other country and say, "Oh, look, Bill Bryson's got another book on Australia out." This didn't happen a great deal, but it happened enough, and then of course they would see that they had bought the same book. It was exactly the same book, but with a different title, and then they would always write to me a letter accusing me of operating a great scam. And so I just wanted to bring that up here, because you should know that sometimes books come out with two titles, and it's happened to me. So, and if you have ever bought my book twice, thank you. Now, this passage I want to read to you it concerns my oldest friend in Australia, oldest friend in every sense of the word, because she was the first friend I met when I went to Australia, and she was just about old enough to be my mother. It was a wonderful woman named Catherine Veitch. And I met her because I did a reading, a much smaller reading than this, at the Melbourne Writers' Festival on my very first trip out there. And afterwards, as they were sort of closing the place down, Catherine came up to me to take issue with me in some gentle way, with something I had got wrong about Australia, or something like that. And anyway, we got to chatting, and it turned out we really hit it off. We just got along really, really well. We had very similar sense of humor. She was just a jolly sort of person. I liked her a lot. And the next thing I knew, she was inviting me out to her family home at St. Kilda, which is a suburb of Melbourne. And I went out there, and I had lunch with them, and I met John, her husband, and a couple of her kids were there. They were grown and more or less my age. And so I just became unexpectedly and wonderfully a friend of the family. So we became great friends, though it was a friendship based almost entirely on correspondence. Catherine had never been to America, and I went to Australia once a year, if I was lucky, and then not always to Melbourne. But three or four times a year, she would send me long, wonderfully discursive letters hammered out on a jumpy and willful typewriter. These letters seldom took less than an hour to read. In a single page, they could range over a galaxy of subjects. Her childhood in Adelaide, the inadequacies of certain politicians, why Australians lack confidence, what her children had been up to. Generally, she stuck in a wadding of clippings from The Age, the Melbourne newspaper. Much of what I know about Australia, I learned from her. I loved those letters. They came from so far away. Just getting an envelope from Australia still seemed to me a faintly wondrous event, and described experiences that were unexceptional to her, but breathtakingly exotic to me. Taking a tram into the city, suffering through a heat wave at Christmas time, attending a lecture at the Royal Melbourne Institute, shopping for curtains at David Jones, the big local department store. I can't explain it except to say that without giving up any part of the life I had already, I wanted intensely to have all that in my life as well. So it was through her letters, more than from almost anything else, that I consolidated my fixation with Australia. Her letters were always happy, but the last one I received from her was especially sunny. She and John, her husband, were about to sell their house in St. Kilda and move to the Mornington Peninsula to take up a life of gracious retirement beside the sea. Just after she sent that letter, however, to the shock of everyone who knew her, Catherine suffered a sudden heart attack and died. I'd have been on my way to visit her now. Instead, all I can offer is my favorite of the many stories she told me. In the 1950s, a friend of Catherine's moved with her young family into a house next door to a vacant lot. One day, a construction crew turned up to build a house on the vacant lot. Catherine's friend had a 4-year-old daughter who naturally took an interest in all the sudden activity going on next door. She hung around on the margins, and eventually the construction workers adopted her as a kind of mascot. They chatted to her and gave her little jobs to do, and at the end of the week presented her with a little pay packet containing a shiny new half-crown coin. The little girl took this home to her mother, who made all the appropriate cooings of admiration, and suggested that they take it to the little girl's bank the next morning to deposit in her account. When they went to the bank, the teller was equally impressed and asked the little girl how she had come by her own pay packet. "I've been building a house this week," she replied proudly. "Goodness," said the teller, "and will you be building a house next week too?" "I will if we ever get the f***ing bricks," answered the little girl. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
So there's a whole bunch of questions in here, and I'm going to try to condense them a little bit. And this might be a little unfair, but what was your favorite book in the 9th grade? Specific, I know.
Oh, wow. I don't remember the 9th grade. My favorite book in the 9th grade, it wasn't anything that we were required to read in school, I have to say. I'm sorry to be so honest, but that's the fact. Because back in those days, we always had to read like Silas Marner and stuff like that. And who wants to read that? But what I at about that age, or maybe just slightly earlier, I really did discover books. You mentioned about my dad's library, and I felt so lucky that it seemed like an immense library. It really wasn't all that big, but to me, growing up in Iowa in the 50s and 60s, it seemed like a really big library. He had acquired a lot of Book of the Month Club books in the 1930s and 40s in particular. And And I didn't know anything about these books. I mean, I knew nothing at all. And I just started picking them off the shelves at random. And it was the most wonderful experience because I didn't know what I was getting into. I mean, I didn't know, you know, whether some of them were really terrible, but some of them were like P.G. Woodhouse. You know, I just discovered P.G. Woodhouse without knowing anything about him. And there's this guy who'd written these comic novels in the 1920s and making me laugh now about a country I knew nothing about at that time. Or I remember reading The Sun Also Rises, and I knew nothing about that and just thought that was fantastic. So it was just the most wonderful experience. I think there's nothing better in the world than to discover books for yourself rather than have them thrust on you. I mean, I know schools have to do that. And we certain books that we all need to read to be kind of culturally literate. But the best thing to do is just find your own books, I think, because it's such a feeling of excitement when you discover something that you think is really, really good, rather than just confirming somebody else's opinion. So I think that's...
Well, thank you very much for tonight. For a delightful evening. We're so grateful to have you here in Portland. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Bill Bryson. He spoke in Portland in 2010. Bryson is the author of several award-winning books, including The Lost Continent and A Short History of Nearly Everything. Thanks so much for joining us this time for Literary Arts, the Archive Project. Bill Bryson was our featured writer this time. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project brings you a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.